Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring an interview from our Youth Leadership Online event that we originally hosted in December of 2018. The full event is available online on our website for loveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, sports leaders develop programs so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. We'd love to hear any feedback or comments down below, and please share this to others in your space so that we can all work together to bring the game back to the kids, because that's where it belongs. Hope you enjoy the chat and you get some great nuggets. Thank you. Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Thanks for joining us for our digital online event through our digital platform for the Love of the Game. I'm really looking forward to talking to our next guest, who is VJ Stanley Jr. He is the founder of Balance Excellence, longtime hockey coach, author of Stop the Tsunami in Youth Sports and Less is More books, which I'm hoping we'll chat about a little bit more in our conversation. He grew up playing a number of sports, a three-sport varsity athlete in high school, went on to play collegiate and university hockey. He's coached hockey for a number of years. He's also an advocate for all levels of youth sports, recreation and competitive, promoting the importance of fun and long-term athletic development. He's contributed to numerous TV, radio, print, online news articles regarding the various issues of youth sports. Thanks for joining us, VJ. I'm actually really, really pumped and looking forward to this chat because there's so many similarities between our backgrounds, and I'm looking forward to this.
Me too. Thanks for having us. We appreciate it. Anytime we can talk about kids, we're in.
Yeah, it's one of my two passion points for me is sport and kids. And, you know, I was in sales for a long, long time, but volunteer coach at night, and now I'm just dived in 100% as it's really important to bring the game back to the kids. So where did you grow up and what sports did you play as a kid?
Well, we played everything. I grew up in a suburb of Rochester, New York. But there's a huge field behind our house and then a huge rock pile at the end of the street. And we were outside all the time. Floor hockey, basketball, baseball, football, soccer. We didn't play much lacrosse, but we made up games too on the rocks and you know, tag, and we raced our bikes. And literally, we were the neighborhood, Glenn, that the mom rang and my mom, my wonderful saint mom, would ring the cowbell at 5 o'clock for us to come home for dinner. I mean, she actually had a copper cowbell. And wherever we were, the other moms in the street would then pass it down. We just played everything growing up. And in high school, I played hockey, baseball, and I played football till my junior year. And then when the offer started to come to play college hockey, I was asked to consider not playing football anymore, so I didn't. And then I played soccer my senior year.
Well, so covered the whole gamut. What was your fondest memory of all those sports?
We won the first championship of the high school that I went to ever. And that was as a sophomore. That was pretty cool. But I tell people this, it's not the actual moment. It's all about the journey.
Yeah. It's how you got there. And for me, the wins are great. But a lot of the experience I have with the wins is the actual what led up to those wins. Like I was fortunate. I was like you. I played in multiple sports, and I never specialized really in anything because I played football and rugby right into college. But the three provincial championships that I won, one was in hockey. It was an amazing experience all the way through. Football was just an amazing experience. And then rugby, it was what led up to those championships and those medals. That is what I remember the most, and the friendships that I developed, as well as the amazing, amazing coaches that I had. I was very, very fortunate. I wasn't one of those kids where, you know, a lot of people in our generation, they did have bad coaches, but all of my coaches that I remember, because they kind of took me under their arm. I lost my dad when I was really young. They were amazing, and they were like father figures and helped us not only become great athletes, but the best recollection I have is how much I learned from them in terms of life lessons.
Exactly. We say when I speak all over the country, we tell the coaches, the parents, the victories are just mile markers, just like if you're traveling on a throughway or an exit. The real test of the championship is, or the wins, whatever, wherever you want to call it, is how these kids are 10 years from now. We had a quick story. We had a very fortunate, they had a really good streak, 51-3 over 3 years. And I was head coach of college hockey. And the third year, the reporter came and asked us, we won the championship last year, how we were going to be this year. And I said, gosh, I don't know how we've done yet. We graduated 31 doctors and lawyers, 28 engineers in my 21 years there. So that's how I kept score. And my point to the story is, I don't know. They haven't gotten their degrees. They haven't gotten married. They don't have kids. They don't have jobs. I don't know how I've done yet.
It's a brilliant analogy. I had a conversation with Dr. Gordon Bloom, who is a professor of psychology, sports psychology, does a lot of work in coaching science. He and Wade Gilbert, probably the coach's doc, spent about 45 minutes each way driving John Wooden to and from a conference. And he said it was like the most amazing experience, all the nuggets that he shared. And he says, you know, I had to ask him, you know, how did it feel, all those championships? And John kind of turned to him and he says, you know, son, it was not about the championships. It's about how all these young men become great men and accomplish all these great things. And goes, but you had all these great guys that went on to the NBA. And Gordon's going, oh man, I never should have said that. I've got John Wood in the car. And it was all about the legacy that he left behind, which made him, you know, the greatest coach of all time, and how he felt. And then what I loved about John is he never used the word wins. It was that whole pyramid of success and how those people became great people, and how he emphasized the importance of education, you know, family, and like the sport accolades were late, and it also took him a long time before he got to that level. So pretty amazing analogy. So when did you actually get into coaching?
Well, after I went to college, I actually got hurt after one game. I had two concussions in a week. They were my seventh and eighth. I went to Clarkson with 20/10 vision and left with 200/300. So I got home and I was working for my dad at the time, and I was at a diner, and the guy asked me, you know, if I ever thought about coaching. And I said, not really. And he said, well, do you want to coach this team? I said, well, yeah, that'd be fun. So I coached there. And then I'm the youngest coach in the history of high school hockey in Rochester, New York, in the 50-year history of the league. And they were having a problem with this coach team. And they said, would you be interested in taking it over? And I've been offered jobs. I want to make this clear, Glenn. I've been offered at least five that I can remember now, jobs where I already were coaches. And I have always had a strict rule. Until you fire the coach, I'm not interested in talking to you about it. I'm not interested in interviewing it. Nothing. We can't go without a coach. Then we can't talk. Because that you have to have, if I'm going to work for you, I have to have that amount of integrity in the people that I work for. Right. Because we're modeling for the children. And so I took that coach over, or that team over. They were 0-8. And to tell your audience what a phenomenal coach I am, I promptly turned them around to 0-16.
Yeah, we've all been there. We've all been there. I mean, John Wooden, 16 years before he won his first national championship, right? It takes a while to learn all the nuances, and you're pretty young. You were in your 20s when that happened?
23. Just turned literally 2 weeks after my 23rd day, and I remember telling my girlfriend at the time, first lesson in coaching that I learned is you can't take a ham sandwich to a steak roast. We had 16 kids on the team, and only four of them could skate backwards, and only two of them were defensemen.
Yeah, that makes a tough gamut when you're trying to match up against some other teams. And I've coached some teams that were way outmatched. I'll never forget one tournament I went to. We actually traveled to Edmonton, and I had a goalie, only one goalie on the team. We were in one game. He must have faced over 60 shots. Like it was crazy. And I think the score was like 20-1 or 20-2. And at the end of the game, he had this huge smile on his face, and I'm saying, "You're okay?" He goes, man, do you see how many shots I saw? I mean, it was, there's benefits, there's pros and cons to it as well, right? So, I mean, winning records take a while to develop, but it's all developed about the culture. So, why did you, I mean, you got into the coaching, and when you started, was there any kind of certification like that you had to do, or was it they just threw you to the wolves and you just took on this team?
Well, no, I didn't have certification. I had taken the USA Hockey, and I want to compliment them. They're small-sided games. They just came out with a play for fun thing. I'm like you. I had three really great coaches when I was growing up, and one of them was actually my father. He was now this is in 1920, but he was in the semi-pro. He was the top catcher on his team in this league. He was, you know, in the All-Star, and his coaching was just phenomenal. He never yelled at us, was always positive, rarely talked to us while we were playing. And Earl Muse and the three subsequent coaches I had after that were all identical. And so that's what I took. And then the other thing that got me into the coaching is that what you just said, I saw so many kids getting yelled at and not playing. And I'm sure, like most coaches, I can do better than that. It started at that age. I don't think that the kids were having any fun.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, because it's a challenge that we face when coaches first get into the gamut, that they originally will default to the way they had been coached, which is the infamous curse of knowledge. They had great coaches, and you know, I've probably had thousands and thousands of coaches in clinics, and I ask them the question, you know, why are you coaching? Probably half of them say, well, because I sadly had a story just recently this season where coach got up there and he said, you know, I'm coaching because my daughter at the end of last year, she said she was quitting hockey, and she's about 10 years old. And I asked her, well, why are you quitting? Because I'm scared of making mistakes. And the whole room just kind of went, whoa. Like the coach that she'd had the prior season just went at them, berated them for making mistakes. I'm a big believer, the uglier the mistake you make, the better, because A, you're going to develop, you're going to get more confidence, you're going to become more creative, and especially in practices, but even in games, because they're going to make mistakes. And Tortorella just shared a quote, and I never thought in my wildest dreams, I was talking to somebody else the other day, I shared a quote that he put on there, it's all about mistakes. What are you talking about? And think about Tortorella 5 years ago, he would berate players. Now he's like gone the other way because he's bought in the whole transformational coaching concept, right? So what then of these great coaches you had, what were their top three characteristics?
They let the kids play. Positive reinforcement was big. And they didn't coach while we were on the ice. I just want to touch back to what you were saying about the guy and his daughter. The coaches now see so much on TV. I call it TV coaching, copycat coaching. Doesn't matter if it's their sport. They see the coaches overcoaching. They see them ranting and raving. The team is up or down, and they're still it has to be age appropriate. And the other thing is, what we tell coaches everywhere I speak, is that you can't allow your A players to make mistakes and not sit them, and then have your B players make the same mistakes and then sit them. You'll lose the whole team. And the culmination of that, Glenn, is the X's and O's are important, but sports are chaos. Where it's inherently chaos.
Yeah.
And the most important thing is relationships.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that's really the deal breaker. If you don't connect with your players, you're never going to be able to take them to glory. I mean, that's really the key to the game. Especially early on the season, and you're going through the group stages of the forming, storming, norming, all that kind of good stuff. If you can't figure them out early on, when you get into those key games where it's a 1-1 and you're going into a last period, how are you going to get them to take that up another 10% so they can win that game versus not win that game? And like you, I'm a big believer in fair play. Every kid on my team has always played, always rolled the lines. The only exception to that would be discipline. there's going to be kids on your team that you have to say, hey, you know what? That two-hander that you took, that player that wasn't called, you're sitting on the bench for a while. You're not allowed to hit kids from behind. What language are you using? It's not appropriate. Like John Wooden, you know, one of his top three rules was no profanity. I'd been like in that space for many, many years, and I recently coached a junior ball hockey team, 17 to 19. That was a tough rule to enforce. But it was funny when you know, as the season progressed, and I told all the guys, no swearing, no swearing. And they go, sorry, coach. You know, they're humbly like, but yeah, it is what it is. So it's the nature of the beast. How can kids then, or what can coaches do so kids will love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning, so we can keep them in the game?
But the most important thing is trust, and trust is a reciprocal truth. I'm my father's son, I'm my brother's brother. No matter how you put that triangle, Glenn, it's always true. Respect, on the other hand, and I'm not political at all, but respect, the office of the presidency of the United States is the most difficult job in the world, or 1A. I have the utmost respect for that office. It doesn't mean I trust. And over again, we tell these coaches, if you can develop trust with these kids, when you drive home today after work, 95% of what you do on the road is trust. If you can put trust, reciprocal trust, at the very top, then it's 6-1, positive to negative, and then it comes back to trust. Trust, trust, trust.
Yeah, and the challenge is developing that trust early on in the season. And the greatest nugget I ever got was from a mentor coach of mine. And I was fortunate to coach softball with him for a number of years, and he's also a hockey guy. And I remember sitting in a dugout early in the season, like probably our second year coaching together. He said, you know, I learned this lesson from one of my mentor coaches. It's really important to establish trust at the beginning of the season. What I've started to do, even though I have a lot of the girls that we were coaching were like a core group, and we'd have maybe two or three change each season. We said every year I trust them first so that they trust us, in lieu of waiting for that trust to develop, because in softball it's a short season. It's about 10 weeks. If you waited the 10 weeks to develop that trust, you're never going. And I think we were together as a team for about 8 years. My daughter loved this guy, like just loved him. He was like a second father. We went to the provincials, which is the equivalent of state, 5 times. Like, that's unheard of. You know, maybe you go once, maybe you go twice. Now, we didn't go deep in those playoffs because we were kind of from a weaker association. But that said, that the trust element and that the developing it is, you know, not only your ability, but your how you connect with your players. And doing that early in the season. So what are some tips you share with coaches in order to do that early on?
First and foremost, I say this constantly, to the coaches, it's all about the journey. This problem in youth sports, this thing, didn't happen overnight. It can't be cured overnight. Our saying is over and over again, peace of mind is victory. But it's baby steps, Glenn. So the very, very first thing is to understand it's a body of work. Don't try and win a championship the first game of the season. It's all about inclusion. Play a lot of kids. This is win-loss record means nothing. Greg Norman was a famous golfer, PGA, and there's a favorite golf tournament of the players, one of the four majors, the Masters. And he used to, when they would interview him, he said, I just want to put myself in a position on the back nine Sunday at Augusta to be in contention. So that's to say, play a lot of kids and don't do newbies and your best. Mix everybody together. And this is a little harsh, but the third one is nobody knows when suck is going to happen. So with the little kid, 10 and under, it's equal play. And that is that much people don't understand. That's much harder to coach than it is just putting your best players out all the time. Think about it. It's a very different concept. Next thing is, and these are all very simple, is basic fundamentals. Stop with all the diagrams. Stop with all the speeches. Let them play, because whether it's Common Core or standardized testing, these kids have so much white noise coming in. And then the last one is, and while they're playing, be quiet.
I couldn't agree with you more.
we tell our players when we were recruiting, and even when I started in high school, and back then, I mean, I was only 5 years older than the seniors. You can't be my best player unless you're my best citizen, and you take pure joy in the success of others. You can't be my captain unless you understand leading doesn't always mean to be in front.
Yeah,
these are simple concepts.
Yeah, and it's basically sometimes leaders, not necessarily the most vocal, it's how they lead in terms of, you know, how they set the tone, their work ethic, all that kind of stuff that a lot of people don't even clue into. Because most parents, not unless they're coaching, they're not in the dressing room. They don't see the dynamics that are happening in the dressing room. They don't see the work ethic during practice at the time. They don't see when a kid is showing up first. They're leaving the ice last. When you look at all the great, great players out there, their work ethic's off the charts. Like Sidney Crosby, he's the first on the ice. He's the last to leave the ice. He goes 110%, 100 miles an hour during practices. And yet people kind of question, well, he's a star player. Well, he got there because of that work ethic, and he's a great leader.
Our most controversial statement that we get in a lot of trouble for saying is, back to your winning statement, is nobody knows how to win. First of all, Las Vegas wouldn't exist. The great Scotty Bowman, who is in the discussion for the greatest coach of all time, won in Montreal, Pittsburgh, and Detroit. So I ask everybody when I do my discussions, well, did he forget how to win in Buffalo? So is that what happened? He actually forgot? He remembered, and like the Buffalo Bills went to 4 Super Bowls. So yeah. Am I to believe they won all these games and then forgot? John Calipari at Kentucky, one of the greatest college basketball coaches of all time, 4 years ago won the championship. The year after, he didn't make the playoffs. The year after, he went undefeated until the semifinal game and then lost. So am I believing he remembered how to win 36 times in a row in the 37th game? He came out of the tunnel and forgot? So it's all about the journey. And listen, nobody's more competitive than I am. But if we're talking about 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds, anything pre-puberty, we should be talking about basic fundamentals and fun.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you. Look at some of the other nations. Norway, perfect example. 39 medals in the Olympics, all-time winningest country since the Winter Olympics evolved. And they don't allow their kids to compete until 13. And that model, I strongly believe in. I don't think we should have a scoreboard until the kids are teenagers, because the emphasis is too much on the outcome, on the results and the scores and, you know, the goals and the assists, in lieu of the actual development of the skills that the kids need to play at a higher level as they go down the pipeline. And most of the kids that are really good early on, they usually wean out of the system, because I call them the early bloomers, or they're just good when they start out. But the late bloomers are the ones that usually evolve and catch them, like the hare and the tortoise, right? A slow, progressive, long-term development. You can't fast-track development. You just can't. And hockey is one of those sports where you're not peaking until 20s, really, and goalies even later.
The male and female bodies don't fully develop until they're 23, 24, 25. Back to the statement before, we've tracked about 5,000 kids over the 20 years I've been doing this. We're at about only 10% of the kids at the age of 10 are the best at 18. First of all, puberty changes everything. And back to your Norway and Finland just won the World Juniors, is that they have play-based education. What we talk about over and over, Glenn, is movement. First of all, nobody gets better sitting on the bench. You got to play. And you got to play a lot, and you got to be able to make mistakes, and you have to have fun. That's it. If you're doing that, these kids are going to want to play for you.
Yeah.
And really, they shouldn't be playing for you anyway. They should be playing for each other.
And yeah, they should be playing. The emphasis on that word play instead of competing at all costs. Like, and that comes from the adults. And John Sullivan, whom I'm a big advocate for, I'm Speaker with Changing the Game, he has a great the adultification of youth sports. You know, it's really kind of evolved to a point where it's not kids playing kids anymore. It's adults competing with other adults through their kids. And looking at primarily the U.S. model, where now I'm seeing it's gone over $17 billion in potential revenue. Like it's just doing this. 10 years ago when I started doing this, it was about a $5 billion revenue. It's become an industry, a major industry. But the question, you know, we're all in this, I guess, battle. We're all in the trenches trying to reverse it. Are you seeing a shift going the other way in the U.S.? And if so...
And they're talking about relationships. And I'm not saying that Nick Saban, he's phenomenal, all-timer. But there is a corporate thing at Alabama. And Dabo Swinney has a little... I'm not saying one is right or one is wrong. But the shift is starting. And part of it is because of all the standardized testing, all this common... There's so much pressure on these kids. Yeah. I'm just going to use the example of a smartphone, but they're answer phones. So if I give you a test with 100 questions and give you this phone, Glenn, you can get the answers. And so now our children, our parents, our communities are misrepresenting knowledge with answers. And that's scary.
Yeah, and it's so readily available. Like you can Google it in seconds. And that kind of precursors that one of the things I tell all coaches when I mentor them is to make sure you can write up all the drills in the world. You can grab a million of them on the internet. But if you don't have the why as to why you're doing that drill and how that relates to a game setting and a game environment, there's no point in even running it. And it's amazing how many of them will just go run a drill. And I said, well, why did you do it? And did you communicate that? And what was the error correction? And all that other kind of, what are the key teaching points? Because they haven't been shown that's the key. I mean, that's where kids are going to develop is in practice. They're not developing in games. They barely touch the puck in games. In practices, if you do a great practice, how many times are you going to touch the puck? 50, 100 times? They touch a puck 4 times in a game. They have 3 shots, maybe, if they're lucky in a high school sport. So, yeah, it's focusing on that whole why concept. And that knowledge is very readily available to these kids because they're going to Google on their phone when they're walking out of the dressing room. And then you've lost the trust, right? You should have incorporated and established right from the get-go.
We're confusing answers with knowledge. We're confusing trust with respect. These are very scary things in terms of the lack of thinking that can go on because those two.
Yeah. So I forgot to ask earlier why the two books that you wrote,
Three Now,
Somebody in Youth Sports and Less is More.
Three Now.
Write them and maybe tell us a little bit about them.
Okay. The first one is Stop the Tsunami in Youth Sports, Achieving Balanced Excellence in Health While Embracing the Value of Play for Fun. I just cannot stress, if you're having fun, you're going to want to do it more and you're going to play better. So, you know, people think it's not being competitive. That fun, actually, you want to get a really competitive game, go play against two of your buddies, some shinny. You want to get it to be competitive? And then the company, we say over and over again, nobody's ever said they've lost their specialization in life. And you lost your balance. You lost your balance physically, lost your balance mentally. So we've gone to specialization and there's a cost. We use the example, if your child has a cold, you go to the doctor and they give them some amoxicillin. Well, if I knew now what I knew then, what I knew now about amoxicillin, I'd have bought that thing by the drums. I'd had it in everything in the kid's house so they wouldn't have had the cold. But you go to specialization and you pay this money, you want special results.
Yeah.
Well, that's not how they're not special. They're not special problems. Just because we paid money does not mean that it's special. It used to be the parents lived vicariously through their kids, and now they're partnering because there's so much money. So if you get that parameter changed where it's about balance, it's about fundamentals, and it's about fun, you look at the problem with different goggles.
Okay. And Less is More is kind of an extension, or is it just addressing other
areas? Less is More, we go right to the heart. Less is More, the truth about youth and high school sports is we just lay it right out. This is the problem. This is what's happening. Here it goes. And then the third book we finished last year is Does Your Mind Mind What You're Doing to Your Body? Because I really believe sports has to get back to what it was in the beginning as a microcosm of life. And so movement and play, all these things, there's now fantastic evidence that that will help you learn in school. And we did a pilot program for inner city where we showed the coaches stop yelling, play all the kids, and afterwards they did a reading thing. Well, after a month, the reading guy came, and they all have to go. The reading guy came running to me in the court before I came to the game. He goes, VJ, you're not going to believe it. Every single kid that's playing on this team is reading better than they've read in a year because they had movement, because they had play, because they had fun. And the other thing is, I said, have them read the books they want to read. Don't just put a whole bunch of books out there and let them pick, because if they want to read that particular book, they're going to get more out of it.
Yeah. And, you know, the old analogy that oxygen helps the brain, I guess, a real simple analogy, but it helps it so much that the data and all the science is really starting to come to the forefront. The importance of physical activity is not just for you to have, you know, from your physical health, but it's your mental health and the resiliency, and as well as, you know, building that confidence, which is exactly what's leading to those higher test scores.
And we want, because of the money, because of the test scores, Glenn, we've lost our sense of community, because there is, I need to excel. I paid that money. I need my kid to excel. That's the test score. I'm not doing good, instead of having everybody together. Everybody, there's a story where a professor in college, an art professor, had the kids making molds of vases. And he took half of the class, divided them up equal talent. Took half of the class and had them make the molds of one vase. That's it, base vase, where my wife could get it better than me. My wonderful wife, 31 years. And then the other ones, they had make multiple vases during the semester, and they separated them, two different rooms. The kids that made the most vases ended up with the better vases. The ones that specialized in the one vase had so much into that that they couldn't get the whole learning process, which is what's the point of his thing. And so that's what we're saying, is that variety, what you said, mistakes, the ability for children, we say we need to embrace the fact that they're children, not take advantage of it. And peace of mind is victory. The, you know, these coaches yelling, screaming, rah-rah, well, that goes away. You want these kids to have, so we call it shock absorber coaching, where they can take all these things and absorb them and not, and then be able to execute and have fun and be able to do things in life, in the classroom, and sports.
Yeah, it kind of relates to the whole the mindset analogy of Carol Dweck, the growth mindset, and that that vase analogy that you gave is similar to the study that she did, where she, I think they were grade 5 students, so 12, 13 years old, gave them a series of puzzles, and then gave them the feedback, whether it was fixed feedback, you know, you're really, really smart, or the growth feedback, you know, great job, great effort, all that kind of stuff. And the kids that were getting the feedback in terms of the growth were taking on more and more challenging puzzles and were continuing to get better, whereas the kids who were getting fixed mindset were not even wanting to take on more challenging, and they were performing less over the course of time. And it's all semantics. It's just a slight shift in your wording, so, and the way that you approach it. So the worst thing, and I remember her reading her book, worst thing you can do is tell your kid they're really smart. That's the worst thing you can do, because they're just going to think they're really smart and they're never going to try. And they hate effort because they don't think they're going to get any better. So it's amazing when you go to that shift and you start thinking, hey, you can get better and this is how we're going to do it. And it's funny when you see that they're, scores are getting better just because they spent a little bit of time in physical activity. And sadly, you know, with the way that we've seen the shift in youth sports, where there's so many kids quitting and they're not getting the physical activity, and then we actually have terms like physical literacy. Like, I know that it's a term, I know it's a buzzword, but like when we grew up, like we just went and played. Like there was no acronyms for what we did and why we did it and fundamental movement skills or what have you, but there's no play anymore. It's too much structure. And that's, I just watched a trailer and an interview, and I want to make sure I get it right. It's In Search of Greatness. And what came out of all those interviews, and this is Wayne Gretzky, they all said, because they loved the sport, they focused, it was fun, they had an opportunity to be creative. They talked about sport being art and honing their craft. And a lot of people don't think about it that way, but it is. It is an art. And the more creative you are, the better you're going to be. That's what we're missing. And when I watch the World Juniors, kind of coming around full circle to it, you touched on it earlier, I know you're a hockey guy. Finland and U.S. have been collaborating for years. And look at who ends up being the top two teams. I happened to be at that game. I watched that game, and that was unbelievable. But I got to ask you a question about the Swiss coach. A lot of people applauded him for bringing them and actually winning that game against Sweden. Did you watch that game at all? Did you see any highlights?
No, I didn't see it.
About 2 minutes left in the game, Swiss is up 2-0. I think it was like a minute 50. And player on the Swiss team intercepts a puck that was in their zone and it forced an offside call. He comes to the bench, I think it's Schmid, and as he's sitting down on the bench, the coach just rips into him, just like explodes. Commentator says, yeah, he made a mistake. He shouldn't have touched the puck, blah, blah, blah. He's hot under the collar, is fuming out of his ears. And I'm like, and nobody thought it was a big deal. Like, he absolutely ripped into this kid, 17 years old. What's your take on that? Like, should that still be happening? Is that okay, coaching?
Great question. But let me put it in two different answers. First of all, kids don't respond to yelling anymore. They don't. There's a whole dynamics, and they don't. You watch the coaches in college yell at the kids on the sidelines. Saban, they ignore them now. It doesn't work. Two, what has happened because of that yelling? I'm not going to get to the Swede coach in a minute, but what has happened is you have kids purposely, Glenn, not trying, because if they don't try, they can't fail. They're doing it on with over 5,000 kids now, and it's a new thing in the last – a newer thing in the last decade. You know, you always had the star player who just didn't do anything. He didn't care. And, you know, you saw him on this team or that team, the young kid, who just thought he and his dad thought he was the best sliced bread. But what the Switzerland coach is missing the point. And, again, I don't know if he's had problems with this kid in practice. I don't know the whole context of it. Is, once again, it's copycat TV coaching. He's seeing other coaches do it. And so there isn't that creativity and, okay, let me do it a different way. And we say peace of mind is victory. If you put your arm around that kid, and when I was writing my first book, I reached out to my former players, and here's the story. We're playing a championship game. And one of my best players had a horrible first period. And I said, you know, when we were asking, what did I do? And he said, well, I came back, I took a penalty, and then I went offsides, which made me think of it. And I came back, and what did you say to me? Or what did I say to you? And you said there's a blonde, the place is packed. There's a little blonde girl halfway up the right side of the stand who came here just to watch you. I think maybe you want to do a little better for her. The trainer pointed it out. I think she's really cute. Now, I want to preface that with her after. I was a professional stand-up comic for 7 years, traveled around the Northeast. So I think humor is incredibly important in coaching. But again, the Switzerland coach, if he would have put his arm around the kid, he gets everybody's attention. So when my assistant coaches came, and most of them played for me, I never yelled at a kid in front of the other kids.
Yeah, singling them out.
In the game. I would take them off the bench in the locker room. I took them to, we always had made sure at college you get it, you know, there's a separate locker room. And that's when I talked to them. Because once he's isolated, then everybody feels safe. I just cannot stress enough to your audience how important safety is. And I'm not talking about snowflakes and in this, there's still accountability, balanced excellence. But the Switzerland coach missed a chance for a long-term teaching moment. Yeah. And we just did a soccer clinic, and I told the coaches, you know, when you yell at these kids, they're going to do that when they coach because they think that's the way to do it. Now, what you just noticed and what other people are noticing is the Switzerland coach is now going to start being the outlier. And to answer your question full circle, that's when the real change comes. That's when we're going to start getting closer and closer to it being kid-centric.
Yeah, I mean, and watching the dynamics of the players that were on the bench, and a few of them actually, they came and they put their arms around and said, you know, it's okay. And this kid just sat on the bench and he completely ignored this coach going at him. And that's the key about Generation Z. They've grown up in the digital era, high self-esteem. You know, the texting is kind of the norm of weaning from the millennials, but they don't criticism does not accomplish anything. You've got to figure out that Oreo effect. You've got to figure out the positive pat on the back. Okay, give them a little bit of this. But the best thing a coach can ever do in that kind of instance is, okay, you know, we got you. A teaching moment, as you said, you know, if you want to bring the whiteboard like Willie Desjardins, which ironically he never used and he's still not using. Now he's back in coaching in LA. It's kind of funny. So kind of interesting guy that's been on.
Can I tell you a whiteboard story? We're playing Colgate. We're down 2-1, third period. I don't know. There's probably a minute and 30 left. We're losing. Our power play is so bad, Glenn. Literally, we would have to improve 100% just to suck. We get a penalty called, and I can prove it. We got a penalty called, a power play on the other team, and literally I said to the ref, can we decline this? And I turned to my assistant coach and said, okay, now everybody's relaxed. But so they get two shots on goal in like 15 seconds. And for whatever reason, their coach calls a timeout. And I think it was probably he wanted to keep his best players on the ice because they were smoking us. Yeah. So our guys came over to the bench, and my assistant coach got my whiteboard. And I said, no, I don't need it. Now, he played for me, so he knew something crazy was coming. So my top unit comes over. And you know how the benches work, so I'm up higher, and I don't have the whiteboard. And my captain says, okay, and in college, my players had to call me VJ. If they called me coach, I called them player. My business card even said teacher of men's ice hockey. We're teachers. So he said, so VJ, what do you got? What do you do or something like that? I said, look, I got nothing. I said, they just got two shots on goal. Do you think if I had an answer to this, I wouldn't have already given it to you? We're in February. Figure it out. This is your thing. And I turned to my third line, who hadn't been on the power play, and I said, guys, you go out. What? And they, I swear to God, they came over to the bench and looked at me. And I said, I didn't say anything to these guys. Go figure it out. Now, the great part of the story would be they scored two goals and we won. But we didn't. We lost. But what really happened, the moral of the story, is that Tuesday, this was a Saturday night, that Tuesday in practice, we always gave our team Mondays off. And now the colleges are doing it and the pros are even doing it. Rest is so important. We had the best power play. We worked on the power play. We didn't work on it. Sticks this way, 5-on-3, sticks upside down, blah, blah, blah. All of a sudden, it took off. We went on a 5-game winning streak. So it's not the moment that's actually going to change it around. Do the right thing, and the positives will take care of themselves.
Absolutely, and they're going to have that confidence is just going to explode. Right. And if you do the screaming tactics, which some coaches are still defaulting to, they're tuning you out. You're not really building their confidence because that's the way you win games is through confidence. I mean, you look at what happened with Clemson and that game. I watched it. I was like, I didn't think it would be that kind of a blowout. I thought it would be closer. I thought there'd be a lot of offense. But that second half, man, they just took over. Like the Alabama, there was nothing left in their tank. Like there was no confidence. They just couldn't turn the corner. And it's a reflection of, you know, that whole culture that they developed in Clemson and recruiting players that should have gone to Alabama and now gone to Clemson. So it's amazing the story that they've done there. So they're looking back, you've been coaching forever. You've been doing a lot of speaks. Tell us a little bit more about Balanced Excellence. I'm kind of late getting to that question, but What exactly is it that you do with your organization?
Yes, thank you. But I want to finish answering. I want to re-answer and answer that to the last one. So we're playing, because I love stories. We're playing Mercyhurst, and we quit. So maybe what you think. We lost 14-1. At the end of the game, I was only playing 9 kids. All my seniors were benched. We got on the bus, and it's in Erie, Pennsylvania. It's about a 3-hour bus ride. within 15 minutes, 24 out of the 25 kids were studying. I had nothing to say to them. Walked to the back and forth of the bus. They had their dinner. They walked back. There was nothing to say. Tuesday at practice, I took the bucket and emptied it in the middle of the locker room. Didn't say anything to anybody. Middle of the ice, trainer got all the water bottles. I sat in the puck bucket in the middle of the ice with my whistle. And we did sprints. And by sprints, it's a really stretching, working out. We led the league in fewest injuries 20 by 21 years. Dynamic stretching, it biometrics, anyway.
Yeah.
So I did it. Then they had the water break. I did it for 20 minutes. Turned the puck bucket over, walked out of the rink, left. As I was leaving, it's a national chain. I don't want to plug them because they're not sponsoring me. I'd already ordered 4 sheet pizzas. Paid the guy as he was coming in, walked out of the rink. 1-7 game winning streak. So you can yell at the kid like Switzerland, or you can play with them. They're kids. It's a game. So Balanced Excellence, there's actually two companies. Frozen Shorts is the one we do for Rotary Clubs and Kiwanis and churches. Inclusiveness, the inner city, make sure that it's for all the kids that sit on the bench freezing their butts off. I don't even care if you're in Florida. If you're not playing, you're freezing your butt off.
Yep.
Now, Balanced Excellence is the near and dear part, is we believe strongly that life is about balance, the Zen of life. What goes around, what comes around. If you stand on one leg, you'll get wobbly. You have two. Balance is so important. The Olympics have it for balance beam. Life is truly about balance in the journey. So when you are balanced, and then your strengths, Glenn, can become a weakness. You get really good at one thing, well, you're not so good at the other. So balance, you talk to the big surgeons. We spoke to AOSSM's National Convention in Vegas. We're telling surgeons, and they're saying, yes, balance, the balance in the body, the balance in specialization in sports. So Balanced Excellence grew out of, I just believed balance was so important in life that it was something that was missing. Again, these phones, what you said, the technology, the white noise, is that we thought balance, we still do, that balance is just so important in life. Sorry, I get all passionate, people.
Oh, yeah, no, that's, kind of like me. I got to go off the deep end a lot of times when I'm up on stage and people kind of think, this guy's kind of a little bit of a nut job, but I'm very, very passionate about kids and I want them to play well beyond, 12, 13 years old. And the statistic that's still killing me 3-4 years after I came across the data is today's generation of kids may die 5 years sooner than the prior generation because of sedentary lifestyles, because of all the stuff that's happening, and they're not getting their 60 minutes. Like when you were playing and I was playing, we weren't playing for 60 minutes. We were playing for hours, and the cowbell was the only thing that would bring us in, like you were saying. Well, with me, if we were out there for the day, we go and we play, and we all, okay, we got to take a lunch break. And that was when we went to all the respective houses, and we took turns crashing a house with 15 guys saying, okay, we're coming to eat. And all the moms, that was the back in the day where moms stayed at home.
Yep.
They'd eat us. And then we go keep playing. Like we change sports and all this other stuff. I mean, if kids play more than an hour outside now, it's like, wow, they're out there for too long. Like, no, they should be. I had an uncle when I was growing up and we were in Montreal and he used to joke. He said, here's a quarter, go play on the auto route. Meaning get your ass out of the house, go play. Right. And he never really had to do that much with me because I was always outside. But how do we get kids to do that more? That's the biggest struggle, I think, on the unstructured side of it, not just the structure. So with all my practices, I don't know how you've ran your practices. I always started with hockey, 10 minutes of stick and puck, and then 10 minutes of cherry time. So whatever you guys want to do. So, yeah, I might have had a 60-minute practice, and I used up like 30% or 25% of the practice time for free play. But without that, they're not going to become creative.
We tell coaches, purposely show up late. Once a month, purposely show up late. Just let them go. Soccer, basketball, football. You have one parent that you can trust for safety. No coaching. but you have one parent for safety. Let him play. We've had coaches call multiple times. BJ, and then when I got there, they were just standing around. I had to do something. No, the change can't happen immediately. Kids have been figuring it out. Look, we say how smart kids are these days, and yet we treat them like remote-controlled robots attached to adults' joysticks and egos. You know, your kids, you've heard this from when they were little. I can do it myself, from two-year-olds. Well, then let's let them. Let them figure it out. Let them make mistakes. But that's the one thing we say to every time we speak. Show up once a month, show up late. Make sure everybody knows what you're doing, right? So they're always panicking. Kids have been playing for centuries. They'll figure it out. And then you come in and you watch and you observe, and now you see what you really need to do.
And for me, that's when I could see the creativity, and also could see the pairings, defensive pairings, the lines. Like my first probably 3 weeks of a season, I had my line set. I had my D pairing set. Obviously, I knew my goalies were as I got older. But like that's a struggle that a lot of coaches will come to me when they're asking for mentorship. I don't know how to put lines together. I'm like, really? It's not that hard. Look at the three kids that like to play together. And then it doesn't matter if they're all A's or they're ABCs or whatever the case may be. It's all about the chemistry. That movie Miracle, the Herb Brooks with the Coneheads. Yeah, coach. All we do is go pass, shoot, score. because they played well together. So, in respective time, I'm going to go to the rapid fire segment. Do you have a favorite book that you recommend for coaches?
Mastery. It has nothing to do with coaching. Author's name is Green. Greene.
Okay.
Because, again, sports is supposed to be a microcosm of life.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with more. That's how we prepare kids for non-sports.
Like, balance. If you don't
learn the life skills in sport, where else are you going to learn it now? Right? Yep. Do you have any resources or books that you recommend to youth sports parents in your travels?
You're probably not going to like this answer. Your kid's athletic ability and what he or she does on the ice has nothing to do with you. I don't care how much you paid. When you're heading to the rink, court, field, I hope you have fun. On the way home, I love you. That's it. That's it. You don't need books. You don't need any of that stuff. You do that, and you will have what you and I have been talking about for the last hour. You will have your child's trust.
Yeah, the hook, line, and sinker for me with John O'Sullivan, Changing the Game Project, when I watch his TED Talk, and he's ending it. When he talked to Bruce Brown, he said, Bruce Brown gives him those five words, I love watching you play. And John turns and goes, that's all you got? He goes, yeah, that's all you need is I love watching you play. And I was in tears when I watched it because that's what my mother told me all the time. Single parent. My father passed away when I was really young. My brother remembers it. But then as my kids were growing up and his kids were growing up and her, grandkids, she would say the same thing to them. And I was like, when I watched the video, you don't put that in context until you're out of that element. And I literally broke down. I love watching you play. That's all they really need to hear. And one of the last things I said to my son after he quit hockey, he came back. We both read Bobby Orr's book. Have you read his book?
Part of it.
My Story.
Yep.
And he talks about his dad. And he says, my dad never coached me when I grew up. Most of my time was on Parry Sound. But what Doug used to tell Bobby before ice time is, Bobby, just go out there, have fun, and see what happens. And so when my son did go back to hockey, I said, so what are you going to do? He goes, I'm just going to go out there, have fun, see what happens. And the smile came back to his face. But for about 3 or 4 years, because of the intense, intense competition and expectations, that smile went away. That's when I knew he lost the love of the game. That's when I knew, hey, there's not much I can do about this now, but I got to turn the corner and figure out what we can do for all these kids that are losing that love and that passion for what they once loved. And you can tell when they stop taking shots in their driveway, they stop going outside, they stop doing all that other stuff. So kudos to you for, writing the books and running the organization. So
hold on one second. One of the reasons, and Bruce Brown is phenomenal, can't say enough about him. John O'Sullivan does great work. Is that we just, because one of my degrees in psychology, it's called bottlenecking. Whatever, they can only take in so much information. One of my favorite things I used to say to my wife with my kids, we really should have an in-earing and an out-earing. because one thing comes in and we know something's going to go. But that's why we just say, I love you. I cannot tell you how many kids, that we're over 5,000, have not heard their parents say, I love you. It makes them safe. Maybe they didn't play. Maybe they, you know, there was a problem with the coach. Just I love you is so important. And then the third thing, obviously, is the parents need to say it to each other in front of the children. It's just so important. They've got to feel safe. They've got to feel loved. And that's when you take risks.
Yeah, and the whole love concept is kind of interesting. Jason Dorlan is someone I got to know over the last year and a half. He wrote a couple of books. Went to the 1988 Olympics for Canada in rowing. They were expected to win the gold medal. They didn't medal. He was devastated. He wrote a book about, you know, how that felt and that whole coming down from the momentum of getting to that level, and it was phenomenal. And he started his coaching journey as a combative coach. He uses that analogy. I was combative. I coached the way like I was. It was all about winning, but I wasn't getting anywhere with my athletes. And then I shifted mindset. I started reading a lot of stuff about transformational leadership, and I started talking about love and wanting all of my players to love each other. And, you know, you're going to think I'm crazy, but these were teenagers. These were 17, 18-year-old young men, and we talked about love all the time. And you heard Debo Sweeney from, you know, Clemson. They loved each other. They went to the end of the earth for each other because they developed that culture within their organization. And it is something, that's the whole reason why when For the Love of the Game was an available business, I jumped all over it. And that's when we went down this path, because we're missing that concept. You couldn't have nailed it on the head more. As a last takeaway I'll share with you, there's a survey that was done by TD Ameritrade. I shared in every one of my presentations when I'm talking to parents and even coaches, where TD Ameritrade surveyed their clients because they're concerned they're not investing enough for their retirement. We're gonna live longer than today's generation unless we reverse the trends, which I'm gonna do everything I can to reverse that trend. But many of those people that came back said, you know, a lot of our disposable income is going to use sports now. And 43% of those parents said it's too expensive. They're spending on average, this is the US number, about $500 per kid, average household to $12,000 a year is kind of the average. So, yeah, that's about right, because I was kind of in that same line with Canada. But here's where it got skewed, and this is what I share with everybody. 67% of those parents were expecting their kids to get an NCAA full ride scholarship as a return on investment. I think it was 42 or 47% thought their kids were going to play professionally, and 34% thought they're going to the Olympics.
We hear it all the time.
I mean, if I can't end this conversation on more of like, that was so extreme. I'm like, well, less than 1%. So that's the big disconnect, is the parental expectations and the kids' expectations. Until they come back in a line, I don't know if we're going to change the tide. And that's the biggest challenge I have when I'm running around the country.
Well, I think that's the fun part, because you and I are both competitive. If it was I tell people after my talks, if it was easy, somebody already would have done it. This is fun to me. This is a $15 billion. Most parents are really, really well-meaning. This is a $15 billion a year industry we're going against. Just leave you with this last one. This should show you how competitive Glenn and I really are. And there's a huge difference between being competitive and competition. And I've never prepped you with this question, right? You don't know what I'm going to ask. I'm going to give Glenn three scores. 88-22, 14-0, 55-56 overtime. 88-22, 14-0, 55-56 overtime. Now I'm going to ask Glenn, this is the first, have I prepped you with this at all?
No, first time I hear this.
Okay. Do you want to play in the 88-22 game or coach in the 88-22 game?
Don't want anything to do with it.
Do you want to coach or play in the 14-0 game?
It's not close enough.
What about the 55-56 overtime game?
I'm all over that one. Like, as far as I'm concerned, a one point differential in any, like, that's what it's all about. Both teams are competitive. Both teams are fair. They're tiered. They're balanced. And that's the passion comes out in those games. That's what it's all about to me.
All right, listeners, this is the most important thing that I've said today to you. I didn't tell Glenn who won. You think about that when you think about this podcast. I didn't tell Glenn who won.
great way to end it, because I, as far as me, the win was not really relevant. It's the closeness and the competition. And as from my perspective, as a last takeaway for everybody that's watching this, early on in this talk, DJ shared about, you know, three buddies going to play and competing against each other. I almost guarantee if he and I got on the ice, there would be a brawl in front of the net to see who would score, even as rivals and camaraderie, because it's all about that passion and that love to score and win and what have you. But I'm like you. I'm very, very competitive. I hate losing. And all my kids used to joke all the time. He says, "Coach, you don't like playing this team because you hate losing." I said, "Yeah, but you know what? We're going to go in there. We're going to give our best effort. We're going to give it a shot." And it was amazing how many of those teams that we actually turned around and we actually got some W's. But that said, it's not just about that win. It's about the process to get the win and the evolution to get there. So this was great. This was absolutely fantastic. I expected going in that was going to be a lot of like-mindedness, and watching your stuff and watching the videos and stuff. The six years ago, you did that video that you shared with me. And have you seen a shift since that 6 year, or is it still kind of where you where
not,
you're at?
It's 6 years? Not linear. It's not linear. It's up and down. But yeah, it's about the journey. It's about like the difference between trust and respect, competition and being competitive. We're cheating with the age of kids. We're stacking teams. No, it's about, if you and I were playing a pickup hockey game and it was 6-0. After 10 minutes, you and I would meet in the middle and go, "Okay, you give me Bobby and Dave, I'll give you Eddie and Joe," because yeah, we want that competition. So yes, we're seeing it, but it's baby steps.
Yeah,
exactly. Time for this problem to get here.
And many kids, when they do the unstructured or the free play, or like when I said, you know, just go stick and puck, or what do you want to play? They can't form their own teams. And the whole concept of rebalancing, they're so used to the adults doing it for them that they don't know. And God forbid, if you, like back in our day, either the sticks you just threw in the mouth there and you played for 15 minutes and, oh, yeah, it's not balanced, we reform, I'm going to take Johnny over here. Or I was always one of those guys. I was the captain because it was one of the top dogs. And then there was another. I hated that kid that always got picked last. So I always picked him first. And everybody would look at me and go, "What are you doing?" Because I want him to be able to play. And he's going to develop. And those guys usually end up becoming pretty top dogs because I always would pull them on my team.
Everybody runs faster when they're being chased, Glenn.
Great analogy. This is fantastic. I could talk with you for like hours. It's amazing when you get on the call with somebody that's just as passionate. So how long have you, the Balanced Excellence, how long have you been at it?
The formal company is 6 years old. But I've been doing this for 25 years. It just started out when I was coaching people. Can you come to this team or this soccer team, this basketball team? Can you do this baseball team? And then people started saying, can you write a book? And then would you like to come here and speak? And it's just evolved. And the object of Balanced Excellence, for it to really take hold, I shouldn't be coaching. I need to coach the coaches so that they can then send the message out. Because if it always has to be me, then my message isn't universal.
It was great. And I'll definitely follow your work. And thanks for reaching out. It was fantastic.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook, For Love of the Game, Twitter, and forlovethegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.